Hey everyone, thanks again for joining us. This is 2 for 1 at the movies on whatsupwestman.ca. Tonight we look at the tilted world of Dr. Seuss and The Lorax. Rich in color and texture, this 3D movie has enjoyed a long run in the theaters and is the latest installment of Seuss movies to join the big screen. Stephen Jackson joins me once again from Toronto as we take a trip to the world that trees forgot. Join us as we venture into the world of The Lorax.
Backyard again?
The model airplane, this time.
Let's go take a look.
Whoa! This is amazing! What are those?
Those are trees. They used to grow all around here. What I want more than anything is to see a real living tree.
Light and day.
So, Mom, do you happen to know if there's, like, any place where I could get a real tree?
More than I can let by, or not more than you've got. Just follow the day. Follow the day. Follow the sun.
Did you chop down this tree?
What's that?
I think he did it.
Just follow the seasons and find the time. Reach for the bright side. You don't see me fly into the red.
Wow.
Okay, so once again, as I mentioned in the intro there, I am joined by Stephen Jackson once again from Toronto, Ontario. We're talking tonight about the movie The Lorax, the Dr. Seuss movie, latest one to be in the theaters, and it is absolutely cleaning up as far as the box office is concerned. How are you doing this week, Stephen?
I'm doing great, actually. Less busier than I thought I was going to be this week. We were talking last week about the play I was helping with, and unfortunately there was a library strike and our play is on hold. The library did go on strike and they have no intention of coming back yet.
That's unfortunate. So they haven't given you any kind of timeline or anything like that?
No, nothing. Like many strikes in Toronto, and we have quite a few right now. You know, no answers, no deadlines, nothing like that right now.
Oh, that's unfortunate. You know, and definitely, you know, not getting into the politics end of it, but with the current mayor, it probably isn't easy as well.
No, he's had a few battles this past week. And again, yeah, you don't want to get too much of the politics, but Toronto is quite a raucous little town with its strikes and the TTC and everything going on. But yeah, unfortunately, yeah, our production was put on hold. Not sure we might find a new location for it or we might wait it out. We were lucky enough to get our set and props and costumes and everything out. Okay. They did allow us to do that. So that was a good thing. But right now, yeah, we know we're going to be putting on the last 5 shows because we have a subscriber base, but just don't know when yet.
Oh, wow. Is it a show that possibly could be performed outdoors or?
Well, it'd be interesting to put our set outdoors. there goes our stability of nailing it to the floor. But it's hard to say. I mean, we're open to possibilities, though our company's never done anything quite like that. More than likely, we'll probably find like a smaller location and try and fit our audience in there.
Right. Absolutely. And then with the sheer scope of Toronto, there's probably those locations, you know, hanging around out there that people can access.
That's true. There is definitely. The thing is, though, is that you know this town is a huge theater town. When you're the third biggest theater city in the world, there's lots of locations, but there a lot of them are being used right now. So it's a case of just being able to find at least a good week, at least in one of those locations.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck with that. Once again, I'd like to just touch really quickly. Thanks very much to CJ106 ACC. Radio for getting our golden toned voices on the radio, I guess you could say. And you know, it's just a great experience to be a part of this, and to say, you know, to friends and family, and obviously Stephen can't pick it up in Toronto, but he can listen online. Hey, we're on the radio. So
It's the great thing is that you can pick up all the broadcasts on iTunes. I've actually told a number of friends that's where they can find them, because again, they don't pick up the station there, but you never know and everything. It's great to have be broadcast on a radio station there. It's just a wonderful idea.
Awesome. So we are, once again, as I mentioned in the intro, we're looking at The Lorax this week. Now, as I had said, this movie is absolutely cleaning up at the box office in Brandon and, you know, throughout the country. You know, especially in Brandon right now, we got some nice weather, and usually that is kind of a hindrance on box office numbers, but we checked this movie out the other day and there was a sea of kids there with, you know, mothers, fathers, the whole gamut. And, what were your initial thoughts on the movie?
Well, I mean, I guess we could probably tell the audience a little bit about what the movie's about. So the movie, is around the story of a young man who gets the idea of trying to find the last tree to impress this girl. But instead, he ends up, he does impress her, but he instead learns a kind of valuable lesson about, ironically enough, the environment through the planting of trees and such. And it's a beautiful movie. I had a chance, it was interesting to watch this movie because I responded afterwards to a friend I was with saying, this is probably the most environmental movie since An Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah.
It really kept that message clear. When I was growing up, I the Lorax actually was my favorite Dr. Seuss character. I remember having, you know, stuffed Lorax and everything as a kid. And so I was really looking forward to this, and I was really not disappointed. This movie is just a gorgeous movie to watch, like all the visuals and such. And I'm not sure if you saw it in 3D, Sean, but I had a chance to see it in 3D as well. And it's just an amazing movie to watch in 3D as well. Very vivid colors. The characters are just really well put together. And some great supporting characters in the animals as well, too.
For sure. We, you know, looking at it as well, seeing it in 3D, it kind of reminded me a lot of the experience in 3D of Avatar. You know, where they had really put a lot of work into that 3D imaging. And, you know, some of the listening to people in the theater is great because you can, you sort of know what's coming, but you can hear kids especially like, whoa, you know, looking through the 3D glasses when you see some of these expansive long shots, right?
That very much. And this movie really is what shows what's best about movies, and the fact that the kids can awe over the 3D images, but they're not completely abandoned when it comes to the story. They're really much brought into the story too as well. And I think it's just a really wonderful storytelling to make it really appeal to kids, but not be too childish so that adults don't get into it.
Right. Definitely, as you mentioned, a very strong environmental tone in there. Now, you might be able to educate me a bit on this. How old a story is it? Like,
That's actually a really good question. I'm not really sure how old The Lorax is. It's quite an old story, I guess. It'd be probably at least the 60s.
Yeah.
And I guess you can kind of feel that effect because obviously that was when issues on the environment were really just starting to kind of come into full gear. But this movie really does really keep that story in the main focus. It's the ideas between the city they live in called Theedville, I think it was called.
Right.
About how it's all plastic and how they don't have any trees. There's a gentleman in town who's a business maker whose job is creating air, and no one realized that if they only allowed the trees to grow, there'd be air.
Yeah.
And it was a very simple story, but very well told and very well informed as well, too.
That's where I was kind of going as well. You know, looking at it, I was trying to do some research before we went on the air tonight and look at some of the time frame of it, and it does have a very very kind of almost it's hidden in there, but it's a 60s sort of political feel almost to it.
Yeah, and that's a rare thing to get out of a children's movie, really, too much. I mean, I remember a few years ago, I'm not sure if you remember the movie A Bee Story, or right. A Bee Movie, it was, with the Jerry Seinfeld one.
Right, yeah.
And it was very similar, too. And fortunately, no one really went to the box office to see that one, which is really quite a shame, because it was quite a good movie. But this one kind of made it very accessible, and also really connected you with, like, the idea of the Lorax and the animals, and how they are affected by how the trees are being destroyed. It's very visual. Like the trees are quite beautiful to look at. The like big puffballs on sticks. It's quite a beautiful movie.
Yeah, it kind of reminded, you know, of a dandelion when it goes to seed, that kind of fluffy look, eh? That there again, getting at the look of the movie. You know, let's talk maybe a bit about the art of the animated film, and it's, you know, it really. Disney has done it for years and years and years, but the kind of Pixar and launch mm-hmm. of movies like Toy Story, it's really taken off in kind of the last 10 years, our generation.
Very much so. And this movie, I knew from the book how visual it was, but even this movie just blew me away at just the depths of colors going on. Like, for instance, like it kind of takes place in two time periods. It's the present time, I guess, with the Thiedville people in the plastic universe they live in. But even, like, for instance, when the young boy is going around the outside of the building, or kind of the outside, it's kind of he's on his little motorcycle, and he's right. In these kind of dark alcoves. There's a darkness in those areas, and then when he steps outside, it's just this absolute grayness that's right. Still very vivid in picture, but still creates quite a difference in feel from inside the Thiedville colony. And then, of course, going back to in time to when the trees were there, there is just such I remember the one thing that really caught me was you remember the scene with the water rafting scene?
Right. Yeah.
And how the boat was sitting on the water itself and you could see the water almost splashing up at you. I was just like, I was just blown away. I was just like, I felt like I was watching an IMAX movie.
Yeah. And it you know, we don't have that here in Brandon, but it does have that feel that it would play really well in an IMAX theater.
It would. Yeah. And I think it'd be interesting. I'm wondering if they did play it here in IMAX. I have no idea. I haven't had a chance to look around. But it was just a very visually catching film. And I'm hoping that when Oscars come around next year, that they really recognize this. Often animated pictures don't get a lot of recognition when it comes to art direction. Right. It usually goes to live action movies, but this one is the art direction. It's really incredible.
Yeah, I you know, talking a bit about the look and beyond just the color there, and here's a spoiler, folks. But when they bring the Wunsler out at the end, Ed Helms, who voices it, was actually I'm sitting there thinking, who is that? Right, you know, it's one of those moments where you know the voice, and then I flipped back into a hangover scene and I'm like, that's Ed Helms right there. But when they reveal him coming out of the big tall house, that type of thing, I just love the look of him with the big wispy mustache. He almost kind of looks like the Lorax.
Well, they made a joke of that at the very near the end, that he did look like that bit. But I think the Lorax makes a comment about, wow, I like your mustache.
Yeah. Danny DeVito is the Lorax too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other great part of this movie, is the vocal talent in this movie. What's great about Ed Helms' character in this movie is that for most of the movie, you never actually see him. You see his hands come out. You see kind of through the cracks of a window right. of what he looks like. But he tells the story so vividly without having a character actually shown. I think that's just incredible.
And it was a neat look to actually have him, you know, reaching out through the bars, because his hands almost look like the Grinch. you know, and when he come out, and then you realize, okay, he's wearing gloves or whatever, but he looked kind of like a monster behind there.
He does. And I think that's what they try to give off, because that's very much how he feels through most of this movie. Because that's, you know, that's kind of the kind of his character motivation. He feels like a monster because of what he did in the past. And the only way, of course, to rectify it is to help this young boy.
Right. Played by Zac Efron.
I know. I was like, if there's probably one complaint, I would say, I mean, Zac Efron did a great job, but he did kind of sound a little too old for 12.
Yeah.
I was kind of hoping to get someone who sounded a little bit younger.
Yeah, I was sitting there, you know, thinking the same thing, and I'm hearing Zac Efron talk, and I'm like, wasn't he in a movie called 17 Again? You know, like, you're kind of, I'm not great with math, but that preceded like the Lorax, and he was older in that movie.
Well, and it's interesting because it took me a while to figure out who the girl was too, and it was Taylor Swift.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, he was like, you just turned like 21.
Yeah.
But she didn't sound nearly as unnatural. Her character does look older than the boy does. Like, there's always this kind of a height ratio between the two of them. Yeah. The other great voice in it, of course, is Betty White. She was just hilarious.
Yeah, she is something else to watch, to listen to. You know, I'm not a big just episodic TV fan, but I have seen a lot of episodes with her in that new show their show Hot in Cleveland.
Oh yeah.
And she's a funny lady.
She is, and she's been funny for such a long time. You know, it's what's great to hear her is when she is not doing like kind of either sitcoms or movies like this, when she actually is making jokes on her own through like either like award shows or something.
Right.
She's quite raunchy.
Yeah.
And my God, you're like 90 years old and you're doing
yeah,
like it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Who played the mother in this movie?
It was a relative no name too. Just give me one sec here. Jenny Slate.
Yeah. I love to know more about her. I loved her voice in this movie. I was almost waiting for the mother to come back on the screen sometimes, because right. She had just a great animated voice, and I think almost everyone in this movie just really took advantage and really had a good time making this movie with the voices.
Yeah, it looks like she's, you know, done some Saturday Night Live work, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, TV series Bored to Death.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Ugly Americans, and then looked like her first sort of movie role was Alvin and the Chipmunks: Chipwrecked.
Oh my.
You know,
she got a better animated film this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I keep, you know, I want to see, it's terrible to say, I love movies, but I want to see Chipwrecked just for the simple fact is my wife and I are looking at taking a cruise next year, and I'm pretty sure it's a Royal Caribbean ship they're on. So,
oh, wow. I saw the first two. I mean, they're funny, but they're just I can't explain it.
Yeah, they're kind of a mess. And then it looks like she's in a movie in 2012 this year, in The Longest Week, that is in post production right now.
So. Okay, so yeah, I think she's gonna be one to watch, and I think you'll find her in a lot more animated movies too. It's kind of like for a long period in time when Disney figured out that what was his name, David, the gentleman who was on MASH for years. End up being this incredible voice person. He was the clock at Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. And you love it when you discover these voices, and it's mostly they just have this other hidden talent that they're really great at.
Right, and that's a perfect segue into Rob Riggle, who was Mr. O'Hare.
Oh yeah.
And if people don't know him, he's in 21 Jump Street. He's done a lot of work with that kind of Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly crowd. He was in Step Brothers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. He had a great time. He had a great voice too. I think that's a great segue into the fact that this movie is not just a plain story. There's a lot of really interesting music in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It had a great score behind it, and it really complemented the movie and had that, almost, you know, how John Williams' music complements a movie.
Very much so. And it's hard to imagine this movie without the music. I remember that there's that song near the end of the movie called Let It Grow.
Right.
And I thought, that's a great little song. And I started going, you know, I hope this song gets recognized next year at the Oscars.
And there again had a very, very 60s protest feel almost to it.
Very much so, with kind of being a protest song, but not as kind of volatile as a protest song sometimes.
Right.
You mentioned the score itself. It was quite interesting to hear some of the orchestral music behind. And sometimes I would find myself almost closing my eyes and just listening to the music in the background. And that tells you how strong of a score this movie has.
Right. Absolutely. We're part of the way through here. We're gonna throw a pitch. It's gonna be a fastball, and it's coming right at Steven. And I know he's gonna be able to hit this one out of the park. We're gonna talk about the writing of the movie.
Oh yeah.
what were your thoughts on the script, and do you think there's areas they could have improved, or was it a pretty tight script?
It was a pretty tight script. And what I liked about it was, I mean, generally animated movies are pretty like linear. Like they're just pretty much, you know, this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end. But this one, because it dealt with two time periods, it actually was a rather complicated script. And I quite liked that. It was more intelligent than some other scripts I've heard recently. And so, like for instance, when they tell the story of the young man going and finding the trees, I really enjoyed kind of the characterizations he created, like the what's his name? Oh, the Wunsler, when he left his family and that family dynamic. And then I really liked how they wrote how they got the environmental message across without being too wordy type thing. I mean, at one point they made fun, and the one girl used the word photosynthesis.
Right.
And that's quite cute. But I liked how they switched back and forth and made you very suspenseful to find out how this story ended. Because at the very beginning, I had thought he created the machine. He was going to create the machine that cut down the trees.
Right.
I thought, oh, that's what happened. Because Mara, early on, he found the blades, or the young boy found the blades to the machine. I thought that's what he invented. But then it was how he wrote the fact that the clothing that he created was what led to the cutting of the trees, which led to, like, it's a wonderful script because it offers a chain of events and how one incident can really affect another incident. And that's really great to show kids, in a sense, because that's how the environment really works. I mean, when you get rid of the bees, there's no pollination, so therefore there's you understand that whole feeling. That's how this movie got across very well without being too wordy.
For sure. And you look, and it's probably a difficult task. You know, I haven't done a pile of writing for a wide range of people. I've wrote for a specific audience and pretty much a specific age range. But to write a movie, and especially a movie that has some staying power as far as the message of it, to write to multiple age ranges, like, you know, you have to appeal to the kids to keep the kids interested in there. But there also kind of has to be that message to the parents, which, you know, movies like Toy Story 3 did really well, I thought.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and Toy Story is kind of one of those anomalies that the writing actually got better as each movie came. Which, I mean, is almost phenomenal to happen. Generally, the first movie is the best one, and then the writing kind of goes down after that. It's kind of the opposite. It kind of got better. This movie, it just, again, a very... they could have told a very straightforward story, and they didn't. And the other thing I really liked about the writing in this movie is that, generally, with a movie like this, like the young boy would have done some actions, made a mistake, then had to rectify his mistake.
Right.
But it was different, this one. This one was very much about having kind of, I don't want to call it really a selfish goal off the top of trying to impress the girl, but as he's trying to impress the girl, he himself is learning something as he goes along too. And he's learning to do the right thing for the right reason versus kind of the right thing for a more selfish reason.
Yeah, it kind of has that hero's journey follow, you know, where... I don't know whether you've ever read the book, The Hero's Journey, but kind of on writing and having that, you know, climax and the call to action and, you know, the different hurdles that pop up in front of them to come around full circle and, you know, find meaning in it, but maybe not the meaning they started out with.
Well, yeah. And I think that's what makes the story so strong is that we haven't really, I mean, it's not necessarily a new writing style, but it's new to films. I find that a lot of the anime films, the main character often makes a mistake during it. This character didn't make a mistake. He just learned beyond what his original goal was. He went beyond his original goal and found something even better than that. And I think that's what's kind of great about this story is that Again, it's that whole journey feel. And I think that's something very cool about the writing of the story.
For sure, you know, and we're talking about the story, and obviously in animated features, more than anything, the voicing is the story, you know, they're the storytellers. And like you were talking before, a fairly strong cast there.
Yeah, very much so. And each of the characters are so distinct. I mean, but one, the thing, the characters we should really give a little shout out to are the animals in the forest scenes. They were just hilarious, and they didn't go too cutesy. That's what I liked about them. That there was a great slapstick action about all these animals. But what was kind of cool about it was, I mean, normally those animals would never all have gone along that well as they did. But you saw how, through these cute animals, just how the ecosystem was being affected.
Right. You run the danger of becoming Ewoks.
Very much so. And I never once for a second felt like these were going to ever turn into that. And, well, I like the Ewoks, but anyway. I just added my stuff Lorax. I have actually had stuff Ewok when I was a kid too.
Well, I do have to say I like the Ewoks a lot better than I did Jar Jar Binks, and I think that was pretty well unanimous across the Star Wars fan base.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and there's been some great articles about George Lucas and racial stereotypes that have been written in the last couple years. You start to see a few of them in a few of his movies. Actually, if you look back at some of the aliens he creates,
yeah,
it's quite fascinating, actually.
You know, especially and one that I kind of comes to mind right off the top is Return of the Jedi. I can't even remember the name of the aliens, but the one that keeps saying it's a trap, right? You know, some of the kind of stereotyping around there, and you know, Lucas is kind of bad for that.
He is. That's why he's been trying to change his image by, you know, making, he made this past year, I can't remember if he directed it or he just produced it, but the story of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Oh, right. Red.
I think he's trying to rectify some of his kind of, I guess, racial mistakes, as it were.
For sure. It kind of plays into the genre, what he was doing with Star Wars, though. And we're getting a bit off track, but
yeah,
I like getting off track because it's fun to chat movies all around, you know, kind of plays into the genre he was doing with Star Wars. Like they were like an old serial novel, and that would have been quite prevalent in those.
Well, yeah, very much so. But you know, they're all very successful films, and you know, they're all the top of the charts for, you know, money making and stuff like that. Unlike a film you just mentioned to me just before, a film by the name of John Carter.
John Carter. I think I'm gonna stake my $1 reputation on this right now. John Carter will lose more money than Waterworld.
Possibly, because actually Waterworld didn't lose money. A lot of people thought Waterworld lost money, but in fact, it actually did make its money back.
Oh, it did break even.
It actually did break even somehow along the way. It did. I can't explain how, but I've got kind of a soft spot for Waterworld because when they made Waterworld and I saw it, and I it was like that one great day when I said, "Hey, now they can make a movie about Aquaman."
Right.
But you know, and that's never going to happen. But you know,
A friend of mine in Brandon would be so happy right now that you mentioned Aquaman. And, you know, possibly somewhere out in the world right now, Trent Bartley is listening because I think he's one of the biggest Aquaman fan I've ever seen. So,
well, they couldn't get he's a tough luck character. But sadly, so is John Carter these days, unfortunately.
What do you think's gone wrong there?
Well, there's so many things that went wrong with this. I think, first of all, I don't know if they really really advertised it well. I mean, I think a lot of people saw the posters and saw this guy kind of facing aliens, but no one could really connect with it. Like, they didn't do any advertising to connect with any certain audience. The second thing they did was they changed a little bit of their source material, because it was supposed to be called John Carter from Mars.
Right.
And I'd heard that the reason why they took the "of Mars" portion out was because of last year when that Disney had released a movie called Mars Needs Moms.
Right.
And the movie just tanked. Like, absolutely no one went to see it. So they're afraid that because the Mars thing was there, that they thought that was the reason why people didn't go see the movie. And it's like, give people some credit.
Yeah, I think title was the least of their worries.
Well, they just didn't go to it because it wasn't a good movie. No. So, like, that's the problem. Like, I mean, it kind of harks back. I'm not sure if you remember a few years ago when the movie Catwoman came out.
Right.
And if there's one thing you don't do when you make a movie based on previous material is you don't change the story too much that the original audience can't get into it. Catwoman was fascinating because the character's name wasn't the same name. She didn't get her powers the same way that she got, or she didn't even have powers in the comic book. She now had powers. I don't know what that's all about. But they didn't do anything right. They didn't connect it to the story at all. And so what happens is you don't attract any new people coming to it, and you don't attract the audience that you already had built in coming into the story. Now, John Carter had a few things going for it a little more. I think the one problem was that I think it got released the wrong time of the year. Generally, you don't want to release a movie that costs $250 million in the spring.
Yeah, it's got summer blockbuster written all over it.
It does. And the problem is, if you release, there's not enough audiences right now to do that. Like, yeah, we're seeing The Hunger Games do that right now. But The Hunger Games has a ridiculous audience following who have all read those books. They've got every Twilight and, like, Harry Potter kid reading these books.
Absolutely.
So of course the kids are going to come see it.
Yeah, and that was the other mention I was going to give there was the Hunger Games. You know, it's a bit like a train running out of control right now as far as, you know, the hysteria around it. And it's exactly what they wanted out of the, you know, the advertising campaign. Wanted.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what they wanted, but I don't think anyone could have predicted what just happened. I mean, it was just, it's like $155 million opening weekend. Like, wow. Like, that just blows me away. But what I'm also hearing is that it's also a very good movie. Now, I'm not sure if I'm going to go see it because the problem I have with the movie is I'm not really up on movies about kids put into a game to kill each other.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm there for that.
Yeah. You're completely right. It plays on the Harry Potter fans that have grown up into this. It plays on the Twilight fans that have drawn into this. And now, you know, they pull in the books from there. The one thing I will say for all these movies, and I love the fact of it, is it's getting kids reading.
That's you know, that's a really great thing, actually, because my partner's a teacher. And so we're seeing the books come into the classroom and such. And it's great, you know, because for a long time, a lot of kids weren't reading books. I think until Harry Potter came along, really, I think the last books that kids were really reading was probably like Judy Blume, which is kind of frightening. You went from Judy Blume to Harry Potter. But you're right. You know, there's a long period of time there where no one was writing the teen genre. Right. And we're now seeing it come out. And it's wonderful because we're seeing lots more writers writing for this genre and people who don't generally write for that genre writing for it. And it's getting kids to read the books. And we know full well that when a movie like this comes out, it's almost like gold for them because it's almost like, can you imagine back in like, you know, like what the, like the, when Shakespeare's Day, if they'd had movies and they'd done film versions of his movies then, that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing like people really latch onto these characters in these books. And that's just an incredible experience to see happen.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, it's great that they are reading. The one problem is they're not reading, you know, Ernest Hemingway and T.S. Eliot. They're reading J.K. Rowling. But hey, it's a start. And in a vastly digital world, it's nice to see, you know, people getting engaged in you know, tangible literature you hold in front of you all the time. Like,
but you know, so I remember when I was growing up, and I was very fortunate. When I grew up in Minto, Manitoba, because it was a school of like 40 kids. And often we were asked to read a higher level than we were reading. So I was reading kind of the teen fiction I was reading in like my elementary school years. And right. Then I was reading adult literature when I got into high school. And so what's great about what's happening right now is that, yes, they're reading books that maybe not the most like, I guess, literature feeling books. But when someone's going to read The Hunger Games, there's a good chance that maybe they'll move on to something that maybe is more literature or something kind of connected to the thoughts going on, like Lord of the Flies.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, you can kind of see where Hunger Games and Lord of the Flies kind of there's a connection there.
Oh, for sure. And like you say, hopefully it does cause people to kind of climb the ladder as far as literature is concerned there, and hopefully get involved and get reading some books that, you know, have some tremendous literary backing to them.
Well, and it's up to parents like yourself and teachers to really kind of take those books and say, okay, you can read those, but hey, let me tell you about this book and see how it kind of connects to this book. And make that connection. And you're going to see kids do that. I think we just, it takes time, it takes patience, but I think you're going to see that happen.
Shifting gears a bit, let's get your pick of the week.
Oh, my pick of the week. Okay. So last year, I was very fortunate to see a movie in the theater called Life During Wartime. It's by a filmmaker. I always pronounce his name wrong, but it's Todd Solondz. Okay, I can pronounce it wrong. He's a wonderful filmmaker. He started out a number of years ago with a movie called Welcome to the Dollhouse. It introduced a wonderful actress named Heather Mazzara. But last year he did kind of the second story in kind of a wonderful bigger story called Life During Wartime. And I really want people to kind of go over these movies. These movies are not... they're very dark comedy, but there's some just wonderful writing in it, and they bring out some of the most amazing actors together who you just never put in the same movie. Just tell you some of the actors in this one. Shirley Henderson, Allison Janney, Michael Lerner, Charlotte Rampling, who is a wonderful character actor. She's quite cool. Paul Rubens is in this movie as well, too. yeah, I know, exactly. And he's very good. But it's a wonderfully dark comedy about three sisters who kind of have these really oddball relationships in their lives and stuff. Now, before you watch that, though, you should really go back in time to about 10 years earlier than that, to a movie he made called Happiness, which takes the same characters from Life During Wartime, but was with different actors, and some very cool actors who, it was kind of one of the first time they got noticed. And I'll kind of give you an idea of some of the actors who were in it. We have Elizabeth Ashley, Dylan Baker. This is one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's first movies.
Okay.
Ben Gazzara. And again, it tells the story of these three sisters who they're quite fascinating. The one sister is being stalked by a gentleman who actually lives across the hallway from her, but she's being stalked by the phone, but he lives right across the hallway and never gets anywhere near her. Okay. There's another woman who keeps dating the wrong men and nearly gets stuck in this horrible, like, green card experience. And then there's the other sister who thinks she's got the perfect life going on, only to learn that her husband is actually a pedophile. It doesn't sound like comedy, but it's a wonderful character development movie. They're both great movies. It's a wonderful filmmaker. So if you get a chance to catch this guy, he's really quite an awesome filmmaker.
Awesome, awesome. And I will throw back to 1987. Michael Jackson was topping the charts at that point. You know, and actually he did top the charts a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, because of his demise, he did. But I'm gonna throw out a movie here, Raising Arizona. I guarantee you've seen this movie, Stephen. And it was one of those dark comedy cult classics that I really liked. And it had Nicolas Cage in it, and he did a good job.
And that's such a rare thing these days. Oh, God bless Nicolas Cage. You know, he really does try. It's hard to believe that there was a time when he actually was this really gifted actor. And he's kind of went through some ups and downs. This is probably when he's in one of his up periods. I think he made Moonstruck not around the same time period, didn't he?
Yeah, it looks like 1989 later for Moonstruck. Yeah,
yeah. And then of course he kind of sunk away for a little bit. Then he got his Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas.
Leaving Las Vegas, yeah.
And then the demise of Nicolas Cage kind of happened, and he really made a whole bunch of really bad movies. I think it was only he had one really good year though. The one year he did Adaptation, I think it was.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. He had a good year that year, but I've actually never seen Raising Arizona.
Oh no.
I'm actually one of those people who've really seen a very few of the Coen Brother movies. I've only seen a few of them actually. I think I saw For Brother We're Up Thou. I think I saw that one.
Right.
Because the music got me into it and stuff like that. I haven't seen No Country for Old Men. I guess I should try and see that movie, but everyone keeps kind of scaring me off it. Just because it's quite a graphic story, actually.
Yeah.
What's amazing about Raising Arizona for you?
Yeah, it's a great film. You know, it's a couple, and it was Nicolas Cage, Holly Hunter. Can't have a baby, and I know there's, you know, people that deal with that all the time. So they get desperate and they kidnap one of the quintuplets of a furniture tycoon or head of a big company, Nathan Arizona, and it's kind of a dark look at them on the run from the FBI while trying to, you know, coexist as a couple as well as raise this kid that you know is something that there is far bigger than they're able to take on at that time. But you know, you got some other people in there that played some smaller roles, but you know, John Goodman was in there, William Forsythe, Francis McDormand, you know, some great sort of secondary characters there. If you do get a chance to check it out, 1987 Raising Arizona, I liked it. It's not a big thinker or anything like that, but it is that dark comedy genre that we were kind of looking at this week for our picks.
Yeah, so you have a film where they kidnap a child, and I have a movie about pedophile, and they're called and they're comedies. How did you do this?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I guess it kind of played out that way, but we'll make sure that we keep our end on the up and up and just keep recommending great movies for people to go out and
and we should probably recommend people if you're gonna take your kids to Lorax, that's a great idea. Probably don't take kids to see the movies we just recommended, right?
Absolutely. That's one of those films that hits play after the kids have gone to bed. I guarantee it. And you know, your kids aren't gonna want to watch, you know, a film when Nicolas Cage was a good actor. So you know,
they're gonna want to see Ghost Rider Part Two.
Yeah, maybe check out Ghost Rider Part Two if they're a little older there.
Maybe not that either.
We'll
episode about Nicolas Cage, the career of Nicolas Cage.
Right. We're getting close to the end here. I wanted to bring up a fun kind of tidbit on Dr. Seuss there.
Okay.
After his passing in some of the research there, after his passing in 1991, now he did die of throat cancer, I believe. His wife obviously took over his estate and basically put the kibosh on producing any of his works for film or for you know, any sort of medium other than his books.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they eventually coaxed her into allowing some of these films to go, and The Lorax just about didn't happen.
Yeah.
And we can blame Mike Myers for that.
Well, yeah. And actually it's funny you bring that up, actually, because I just heard recently that, cause it was such a disaster of, I think a few movies had actually helped it. I think The Grinch helped a little bit. It was quite a success. As well as Horn Hears a Who was actually quite a good success too.
Right.
But I've heard recently that they are going to be remaking Cat in the Hat.
Okay.
As an animated film now. They're not going to do the live action right again.
Yeah, because she actually was quoted in an interview after the Cat in the Hat come out, and you know, basically stating that film was terrible, and that none of his works would ever be licensed for film again. Now, obviously, they were able to convince her otherwise, and by paychecks or the proper production team coming forward. But it's funny.
Maybe
to think
it was
through
the goodness of her heart that she allowed it to happen.
So I guess, you know, in a way, us being here tonight talking about this film, we have no reason to thank Mike Myers for that.
No, there's a lot we shouldn't thank Mike Myers for. Yeah, I can't say much. The Austin Power movies were just hilarious.
they were good fun, but yeah, it was just kind of a neat little trivia tidbit that The Lorax just about didn't happen because of Mike Myers. So I'm just gonna make a quick closing mention, and thanks once again to CJ106, Assiniboine Community College Radio, for giving this guy from Toronto and myself an opportunity to yak about movies for an hour and hopefully have a couple of people listening to us, which is even better and exciting to think about. I'd also like to take a moment to thank Stephen for joining me once again.
Well, thank you again, Sean. Thanks for joining me as well.
And we look forward to, hopefully in the next week or two here, we're going to devote an entire show to talking about summer blockbusters and what to look forward to.
And, oh, yeah. It's going to be a big episode, I think.
That will be a big episode. And I hear that there's a movie coming out this summer that involves a ship.
Oh, not. Are you talking about Battleship?
No, I'm talking about Titanic, my friend.
Oh, God, that too.
And on that note, thank you very much for joining us this evening. We hope to talk to you again real soon. Bye now.